Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's to the best of our knowledge, we are getting medieval in this hour. And here's something for all you English majors.
Juan that April, with his shortest suit, the drought of March hath pierced the root, and bathed every vine and switched liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the flower. When Zephyrus ache with his sweet breath and spirit hath in every holt and heath, the tender cropus and the young sun hath in the ram his half course he run.
The opening lines of The Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer, written more than 600 years ago, and college students still have to memorize it. Medievalist Bruce Holsinger has given Geoffrey Chaucer and his friend and fellow poet John Gower some new adventures in a thriller called A Burnable Book. Bruce, when your novel opens, the year is 1385, which I know you think was an important year. Why? What was happening?
It was a really important year. It was the year a truce with France was about to expire. We're only 4 years after the Great Rising, the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Richard II has been on the throne for a number of years, but he's still only 19 years old. So it's really an extraordinary time for city and country alike, and just a general time of crisis. The age of Richard II is called an age of crisis for a reason.
Are there any parallels you'd draw between the world of 1385 and our world today? I mean, in terms of, I don't know, the zeitgeist, what people were thinking or worrying about, or even political or social issues?
I would. I think there are a lot of parallels. There's a lot of parallels in terms of communication, which obviously moves a lot more slowly. But anything you write can get out of your hands immediately. Somebody has compared what happens in manuscript culture in the Middle Ages to tweets gone wild. You know, if you write something, your scribes can take it and revise it and twist it and distort it any way they'd like.
But that's fascinating because, you know, a lot of the plot of this book revolves around a single copy of a book that everybody is hunting for. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, it's so hard to imagine an age when there would be just one copy of a book. You know, we live in the age of infinite digital copies. And yet at the same time, information is still power. Think about the furor over WikiLeaks or the hunt for Edward Snowden's files.
Exactly. And in the Middle Ages, manuscripts did have a kind of auratic charge to them. You know, single manuscripts could be invested with kind of enormous sacred and political and cultural energy. So you have manuscripts like the Lindisfarne Gospels. Beowulf, for example, survives in a single manuscript. So does Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
If a manuscript had that kind of charge, how did people think about language, writing? They must have felt even more potent to them than it does to us today.
Oh, it does. And the Middle Ages gave us some absolutely wonderful metaphors for thinking about writing. Almost all writing in the Middle Ages is done on animal skin, on parchment and vellum. And people are very self-conscious about that. Writing is an act that is done upon a physical body. The physical act of writing is in some ways an act of torture, an act of pain upon this body of skin. So those kinds of metaphors, I think the notion of writing in the Middle Ages is a very physical notion. It's a very incarnate notion, and it goes along, of course, with an incarnate religion that thinks very carefully about faith in terms of the body, the relationship between the flesh and the spirit, and so on.
Hmm. No wonder the writing was earthier in some ways.
It is earthier. It's very – although there's a lot of earthy writing today as well, of course.
I was thinking, well, no, there's Fifty Shades of Grey.
Fifty Shades of Grey has nothing on the medieval fabliau. I mean, there have been court cases about whether it's okay for Chaucer's Miller's Tale to be taught in high school. I mean, there's enormous amounts of obscenity in medieval literature. And that's one of the things that I love about medieval literature is how – its bodiness, its earthiness, its bodiliness.
You know, it also sounds different. I mean, it's written in Middle English, a lot of it, right?
Yes, indeed.
Is there any of it you have by heart that you could recite? Because I always love hearing what the words sound like.
Absolutely. Well, my favorite passage in all of Middle English literature comes near the end of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which is a romance written at the same – roughly the same time as the Canterbury Tales and the events that take place in a burnable book. And my favorite moment comes when Sir Gawain is walking along about to meet the Green Knight, and he knows he's maybe facing his death. He's pretty sure he's going to get his head lopped off, and he passes by a cliff, and the poet writes, "Van heard he of that he hot he hill, in a hard rock beyond the brook, in a bonk, a wonder brem noise, quat, it clattered in the cliff, as it clave should, as on upon a grindlestone hath grounded a seath." And what's happening there is he's passing by a high hill, a hard rock beyond the brook in a bank, and he hears a noise. What? The noise echoed in the cliff. And what was it? It was somebody sharpening a scythe upon a grindstone. And what Gawain is hearing is the sharpening of the axe that's about to cut his head off.
Oh.
And that's,
oh.
I mean, that's suspense right there. That's worthy of anything in Stephen King.
So we should back up and talk a bit about the plot. Can you just sketch the plot for us a bit, would you?
Sure. Well, the way I like to describe this book is if you could imagine a season of The Wire set in Chaucer's London, you'd have something like what a burnable book feels like. The story itself is about a hunt for a dangerous manuscript. It's a book of prophecies foretelling the deaths of England's last 13 kings. And the final prophecy in the manuscript, the 13th prophecy, concerns the death of Richard II. It's a story of murder, crime, vice, urban corruption, political intrigue, and also a lot of moving parts and points of view.
God, I hope HBO is calling you.
not quite yet. We'll see.
It's such fun talking with you. I guess I just got one last question. It's sort of a large one, but I'm curious to know what it means to you to have a historical imagination, or if that phrase means anything to you.
You almost have to leave the fact behind from the beginning. And I think to have a historical imagination that allows you to write a historical novel, let alone a historical thriller like A Burnable Book, you have to value the past on its own terms while translating it into contemporary terms. You have to take this world that can seem utterly foreign in so many ways, a world of utter depredation in some ways, but make it a kind of living and breathing thing for contemporary audiences. And that's the real challenge, I think, with historical fiction. And I think it's what distinguishes great historical fiction, something like Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, that takes you into just the most intimate moments of people's lives living 500 years ago and yet makes them absolutely compelling for contemporary readers. And I think a sense of empathy is absolutely necessary for that, that notion of reaching across time and touching the past in a way and thinking about how past lives can come to new life in the present. I think that's the kind of historical imagination I think that I strive for.
Bruce Holsinger is a medieval scholar who teaches at the University of Virginia. A Burnable Book is his first novel, and he's just come out with a second in the series. It's called The Invention of Fire.